Welcome back to Switchcast Season 5. I'm your host, Doug Tabbitt, here with your co-host, Tyler Hiss.
Who am I? What's going on? Tyler Handlers. Absolutely not. Is this only for the audio podcast, Ethan?
It's been 2 weeks, okay? We recorded last week's episode.
The glass has been shattered. Everything is a lie. That's all right, ladies and gentlemen. We're still here.
Like Tiger King, I'm never going to recover from this. Switchcast is the automotive news and entertainment show that's not just for car people. We are so happy that you're here with us tonight. And if you enjoy this podcast, please help us out with the algorithms. Like, subscribe, share, review. It all helps us with that AI stuff in the sky. And it's working. We appreciate you. We appreciate your loyal listenership and telling other people about it. And very much appreciate when I run into people at car shows and events and stuff, and you tell me how much you love the show. And I take it with a grain of salt. But
well, you feel like people have to say that to you just because you're in front of their face?
Well, sure, yeah. But no, we do appreciate all the feedback, and we are on an exciting journey here to create something that we believe is pretty fun and awesome for everybody. So we're enjoying it, and we are glad that you are along for the ride and supporting us, that we're not just talking to ourselves with some electronic equipment surrounding us. But again, please help us out with that. We do want to continue to grow so that this is a sustainable podcast, and we're not asking for your money. We just want you to help us out and share wherever you can. Also support our sponsors, Nuts for Sticks, Switch Cars, and Sheffield Watches. With that said, let's get right into it. I am no Ed Bolian, so I do not put it out there that I like cars with crazy stories, flood damage, multiple brands on the titles. In fact, exactly the opposite. At Switch Cars, we like to deal in pretty clean cars, service nicely, as little paintwork as possible, and very, very clean titles, not because they've recently been washed.
Wait, the cars or the titles?
The titles.
Oh, gotcha,
cars, okay. Being washed is okay. Titles, not so much. Money, don't want it laundered either. Speaking of,
I was going to say, where? Segue.
Yeah, too soon, but we'll get there. That is where we're going tonight. Recently, we seem to have been offered quite a few cars with some backstories. So just recently, we covered a Porsche Turbo that was involved in an alleged money laundering scheme and was seized by the government as part of the civil asset forfeiture along with that case. Well, just last week, we got offered a McLaren 570 GT on trade. Now, I am not much for McLarens other than the McLaren F1, which is the greatest car ever made. But modern McLarens are lacking somewhat in quality and reliability. They're very expensive to continually own and maintain. They drive awesome, really great performance cars, but I try to avoid them for inventory and just in general. They're just too much of a liability. But we did get offered one on trade, and I'm not going to say no other than to like classic pro touring stuff because I have no idea how to value that. But I shopped it around to a bunch of dealers to see what the highest bid was. And in performing our due diligence and scouring the internet for this car, we came up with some really interesting history. This car, quite recently, back in 2023, now, side note, this did not appear on Carfax, and that'll be important in a little bit. But in 2023, the car sold through Apple Auctioneering Company, which is a seized asset management and government liquidation firm.
And I love that the logo on the website, this website, first of all, looks like it's from about the year 2001. And the logo is a gavel, except instead of a hammerhead, it's an apple. And it's like kind of cheery, looking. Like, it's a nice shiny red apple, and we're here auctioning off things that have been seized.
Hmm. Yes. So this car indeed was seized, and this was a not a U.S. Marshals auction. It Department of the Treasury auction. That's right. So it was seized because of non-payment, non-filing of taxes. So it had to do with an IRS seizure. But we started looking into this car to find out what in the world went down, and it uncovered quite the story. Now, again, important part is this did not show up on Carfax because this was a small enough auction that they did not report to Carfax. So if you sell a car, or if a car gets sold through Manheim or Odessa or one of the big auctions, when you run a Carfax, it'll show that it was sold at an auction. Does selling a car at an auction make a car bad? No. But there's an old saying that not all auction cars are bad, but all bad cars go to auction. So it's a reasonable takeaway that when you see that a car sold at auction on the Carfax, that you want to be a little bit more careful of it, because that basically says that a dealer didn't want to sell the car retail. Now, that may be because it just didn't fit into their niche of inventory, or some other reason. They didn't know what the car was worth, or it had aged out in their inventory, and so they have a policy that every 60 or 90 days, everything goes to auction automatically. But you at least want to be more careful. So that's a first caution flag. But this car did not show up on Carfax. It just straight up sold at this government seizure auction. Now, looking into it a little bit more, it uncovered some fun stuff. So this was one of six automobiles seized by the feds when a West Palm Beach bookie was arrested and charged with federal tax and money laundering charges in addition to other things.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
Bro was doing some stuff.
Yes. So we're referencing justice.gov and miamiherald.com for our sources here. And according to this, Dion Di Cesare, which I butchered his name, but I am not Italian, pleaded guilty on June 14th of 2023 to tax evasion, operating an illegal gambling business, conspiracy to commit money laundering, and using a facility of interstate commerce to carry on any unlawful activity.
Ooh, that's a scary mouthful.
Indeed. At the time of this writing, he was not sentenced, but he was eventually sentenced to 71 months in prison, less than the possible 50 years that was the maximum for these charges.
I say, that doesn't sound all that bad in comparison. That's what, seven? Can I math?
No, you can't math. Oh, it's okay. Like 5 years.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, he pled guilty, so there was some sort of a plea deal, and so he got off a little bit easier. But this is quite a fun one to unpack. So reading all these different articles and putting the information together, this guy was running an illegal bookie business, and he had a website, which this was before internet gambling was okay. You know, now sports betting is widely promoted and by colleges and everything. You know, people have been put in jail and had their Hall of Fame honor stripped in the past for betting on stuff. And now it's like, you know, just the wild, wild west. Everybody's encouraged to do it. But
that's now I think the ads are on PBS. It's where they're everywhere. Like, is this just normal? Are people just doing this?
Right. The NCAA gets a huge kickback yeah. from all this stuff, and colleges are making money from anyway, we're getting political here. However, not only was this guy operating an illegal bookie agency, but he was laundering this money through different real estate operations. So he bought a number of different residential properties, different condos, as well as a couple of commercial properties and a lot of cars and Rolex watches and, you know, all the things that you do when you're making a lot of cash. One of his issues, though, is with the money that he seemed to be laundering, he bought a couple commercial properties. And one of those commercial properties was operating a strip club. And out of this strip club, he owned the commercial property and he was renting it to the strip club. They were paying him rent, But then the strip club was also running a prostitution ring out of that. So he's taking money that he made illegally, laundering it, and then laundering it through another illegal business and getting money from illegal activities. So really, really dirty money.
Oh, my goodness. Look, I'm not an expert in this. I ain't trying to do... I'm above board all that. But you don't want an onion of bad. I feel like we've created... We talk about a lot of onions on this. This is just... You're asking for it.
Yeah. And let's say this, too. That cash was probably dirty in more than one way as well.
Yeesh.
A couple odd things that I noticed in this court filing. The properties that were seized, there was a number of residential condos that were seized. Now, his personal residence, valued at over $2 million, was not seized. I did not unpack the legality of this, but I know that Florida has laws that protect personal residence in a number of legal proceedings. So if you get sued in some like civil liability thing, they can't touch your house. Now, I don't know if that applies to criminal proceedings or not, but somehow this guy got to keep his $2 million house in the midst of all this. He had a Land Rover LR4, a Porsche Cayenne GTS, this McLaren 570 GT, a blue BMW i3, and a Chevrolet Silverado, among other things that were seized. But he had a number of condominiums that were owned through Ware LLC. And he bought all of them in 2009 and 2010. So his timing was impeccable. He bought one for $28,000, one for $22,000, one for $25,000, one for $17,005, another for $22,000, and they are valued now between $70,000 and $120,000.
Whew, that is... you know, if I was back when I was very young, and if I would have had all of this cash, I would have done some similar things, purchasing properties, none of the illegal stuff. But I love looking at lists of cars that come up in cases like this, because you kind of get to peek into the mind of the person that that has done some of this stuff. And all these cars are depreciated luxury, all black, all probably look imposing and intense, except for that BMW. Where did that come from? Why is it here? What did he use it for?
Maybe he bought it for his prostitutes.
No.
But his commercial properties were terrible investments. He bought both of them in early 2008, which, yeah, April of 2008. So let's rewind. The commercial real estate bubble was just ready to pop then. So everything was falling apart, but had not yet in April of 2008. The odd thing is, both of them he bought for the exact same dollar amount, $637,992.
Feels odd.
Odd. Didn't look into it, but it's definitely odd. One of them is the El Calabozo restaurant, and the other one was the Whispers All Girl Staff Adult Entertainment and NXT Social Members Club. So there you go. Both of those are appraised now between $250,000 and $400,000. So he took quite a hit on that front on his commercial property, but doesn't matter. The government owns it all now, and they sold it off after convicting him and sentencing him to prison. So, crazy story that just came randomly out of some guy that wanted to trade in a McLaren. The question for us car people is, what does it matter?
Yeah, is there anything wrong with the car?
That's a good question. So when I get offered a car like this on trade, what impact does this history have on its resale value? Now, on a McLaren, really none, because McLarens are just so bad, it almost doesn't matter what story they have. But
already depreciated. It's fine.
I think I called like six different dealers on this car. One of them, who is a McLaren dealer, basically just sent me back a text that said, no, they didn't want it. Everyone else, so Carfax retail value, which is usually pretty accurate, shows $125,000. MMR, which is Manheim's wholesale estimate based on actual auction transactions, was 115 grand. The highest bid that I got was 105 grand.
Yeesh.
10 grand below supposed wholesale, which tells all the internet supposed experts that just because you look up what people are asking online doesn't mean you know what the actual market is. Real wholesale market is what dealers are actually paying and willing to take a risk on. And for this McLaren, they were not willing to take a risk on it.
Do you think the risk was because of the McLaren itself or because of the history?
I don't think any of them dug into the history like I did. I think it was just that it was a McLaren. Now, an IRS seizure is not as bad as like a repo, right? So if somebody's not paying their bills, they're probably also not paying their service bills and not generally taking care of the car. A bookie, maybe he was taking good care of the car. And the auction photos don't look like anything is wrong with it other than a janky rear spoiler has been installed on the car.
Looks like the front end lift is up too, but like... Eh.
Yeah. Okay. So somebody put the axle lift up for the auction because, you know, the towing guy probably put it up and didn't put it back down. So, okay. But, you know, that interior might need a deep clean.
Just don't go in there with a black light.
Yuck. Anyway, we didn't get the car on trade, which is totally fine with me. I don't need to use McLaren in my inventory. I prefer Porsches and Ferraris. So Dion is still in prison as far as we know. And, you know, I'm sure he'll have some money hiding for him when he gets out.
Yeah. Speaking of Ferraris, though, I think it may be time to transition to Wall of Shame. So you got a story in, you haven't really filled me in, so fill me in on the details.
Okay.
From a friendly local dealer, I think.
This is a great tip from a local dealer, and it's just, it's anecdotal, but it is hilarious. Ferrari owners can be a special breed, and this dealer related to me the time that he had a Ferrari 360 for sale, which is a fairly good, easy to sell Ferrari, lower maintenance on the spectrum of Italian cars. And he said a customer had flown out from California to look at this Ferrari. He had gotten a hotel, a rental car, the works. So he was heavily invested in just coming to look at this car.
You would think somebody does that, they're ready to buy. Like, let's go.
In
as
theory,
long as it
yeah.
isn't, you know, the wheels don't pop off when you open the door.
Right.
Like, let's go.
Right. So the guy walked up to the car, noticed that a valve stem cap was missing, put his hands on his head, was completely aghast, and said that no self-respecting Ferrari owner would let that happen to their car. And he asked the dealer, like, what happened to this car? Like, what else is wrong with it?
Wow.
Because a valve stem cap was missing.
Making a mountain out of a molehill there. My goodness. It's just a valve stem. I've had the boys down at the local tire shop replace valve stem caps I didn't want replaced before.
Yes.
I was like,
well, when you have
the
aluminum Ferrari branded valve stem caps, which isn't even what you get from the factory. You got to buy those aftermarket. They're the friggin' black plastic ones from the factory. But anyway, the guy turned around, left, went back to California, and did not buy the car because of a missing valve stem cap.
His loss.
And we make fun of Corvette curmudgeons.
Nuts for Sticks is a brand celebrating the manual transmission in all its forms. So forget those flappy paddles because we like shifting ourselves. Check out our fun and funny stick-themed shirts at nutsforsticks.com and save 10% on your order using the discount code SWITCHCAST. That's nutsforsticks.com and use code SWITCHCAST.
Barn finds have been a thing of increasing popularity for quite a while. And even so, with the introduction of preservation classes at different Concours events, and even this past weekend at the Hilton Head Island Concours event, which was my first time there, there was a class entitled Barn Finds. So it was entirely dedicated to totally original, I guess you could say preserve, maybe not preserve, but they made it through.
They are still here.
They're still here, cars. There's a fantastically rusty, but original and awesome Shelby GT350 and some other cars that were a little bit nicer, but still original. Going back to the saying that they're only original once. Yes.
I think there was a class similar to that at Amelia this year. Wasn't that? I feel like I remember it. Or am I thinking of Audrey? And there was like a preservation class, a bunch of rusty but beautifully preserved cars.
Indeed. Indeed. So on the heels of that, now there's auctions that are coming up. We've seen barn finds here or there, one or two at an auction, sometimes with so much dust on them that you're not sure if they sprinkled it on before the auction for the effect. But there was an entire auction recently. It was the Rudy Klein collection that RM Sotheby's auctioned off. And it was, I think almost everybody has heard of this. If you haven't, go and check it out. We'll put some pictures up of here, of course, so you can see some of these dilapidated classics.
That's putting it very kindly, I think, for most of the stuff in here.
Yeah, some of them you're not sure what they are. But there is a lot of buzz about the numbers that some of these cars fetched. Right, the high sale being almost $10 million for an alloy Mercedes 300 SL Gullwing that needed a complete restoration, all the way down to a couple thousand dollars here and there for absolute complete rust buckets. And I think Simon Kidston put it best when he said, "Rust is the new gold," and certainly it is. Now, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the Broad Arrow auction at Chattanooga and unpacked some of those results and said, well, is the market down based on these results? Not necessarily. It may be partly the quality of cars, the location, the hype. And there was certainly a lot of hype surrounding this auction. And almost everybody I know in the car world was there, and half of them bought cars. Everybody I've talked to so far said, I bought an engine there, I bought a car there. So there's a lot of stuff there. But let's unpack it a little bit and see if there's anything we can actually glean from this other than just, you know, every auction, there's the high sales, which sensationalists tend to, well, sensationalize and say, this is what the market's doing based on these record sales, or the low sales, which, again, people will take and try to make something of. But is there something that we can take away from this auction?
I think something that we can take away is I have thought for the longest time that barn finds are kind of dead. The age of the internet, everybody trying to find something, everybody super excited about whatever is going to kill the barn find, they're all going to be found. But I think we might see, maybe this isn't as fun and innocent and like, oh my God, an individual found this, it was my grandfather's. We might see more of things like this in the future where it's kind of hopped up because it's exciting, which I'm kind of, the audience getting to see what is in this collection after so many years is pretty cool. I'm not surprised you know a bunch of people that bought engines, because there was, I think, more Porsche engines here than there ever have been at the factory at one time. Like, I just kept scrolling. It's like two pages of Porsche engines. And I'm like, these all can't run.
Well, to your point about thinking that barn finds are dead, right? If anything, they're becoming revived because people are seeking them out now in the age of the internet because they get so much attention. So just last year, the same auction house, RM Sotheby's, auctioned off a notorious barn find of Ferrari race cars and street cars that had been damaged in a hurricane. And they were, that was, the hurricane was back in 2004, but they had been moved to Indiana and stored in a warehouse for a number of years, never touched, never fixed. And I had seen them back in like 2008 or nine. And they just auctioned them off last year. So after 20 years, somebody finally unearthed these cars, and a lot of them will be restored. So I think we will continue to see barn finds coming out of the woodworks, but maybe not quite the personal finds. They're going to be more these spectacular auctions and a lot more publicity behind them.
I think some of there's a lot of cool stuff. You've probably seen a bunch of headlines about all the money and like the Miuras and the old Mercedes. There are two cars that stood out to me as just so cool, and I had never heard of them. So there's this 1971 NSU RO82 Porte Plus 2 by Pininfarina. That is some gorgeous, bizarre, I'm pretty sure rotary powered thing that I'm sure Myron Vernis is just drooling over.
He bid on it.
Did he really?
Our friend Myron bid on it up to like a tenth or... Yeah, no, I'm sorry, a fifth of what it ended up going for. He was baffled at the final amount.
It was because he's got one or two NSUs that I've seen, and they're really cool, and I know he's passionate about them. This is gorgeous. The orange plush interior. Oh, my goodness. So cool. The other thing is an 85 Audi Tracer Largo. No idea this tuning company existed. It's some, like... almost looks extended, but it's some weird coach built thing that has just been sitting here for decades. I love this kind of weird stuff.
That might be the one that our friend Freddie Tavares bought. He did buy an old Audi Quattro of some sort. It might have been that one. So we may see this in the future. And there's an important point to this as well. I think that's part of what's driving the value. The YouTube phenomenon is a very real thing. There are YouTube content creators out there looking for the most ridiculous, crazy, nutty stuff that they can buy because it gets clicks. I bought a million-mile Ferrari 456 GT, right? A 5,000-mile Ferrari 456 GT in perfect condition doesn't get any clicks. So I think that was part of it. There was multiple YouTubers there and people looking for content buying stuff. Just for that.
That kind of, this might start a whole other thing, but that stuff kind of, I'm conflicted because I love getting the attention to weird cars like this. I love seeing them restored in some capacity and put back on the road. What I don't like as much is an inflation of values because there is YouTube money going into, I need this or I can restore this. You know, you can't really do this without that kind of money. So it's a double-edged sword. Although this going for $6,000 is maybe not the end of the world.
I don't think so. There was a significant amount of cars that sold for very, very little money. Everybody was talking about the big dollar cars, and let's talk about a couple of them. So the big hitter one, of course, was the Mercedes SL 300 Gullwing, 300 SL, that sold for nearly $10 million. Now, I know anecdotally somebody who helped with the purchase of this car. And despite what other auction results are, this was an alloy Gullwing, so it's worth significantly more than a regular Gullwing. And they estimated that fully restore this car would be worth about $12 million. And a restoration will cost about $1 million. So as much as you could say, well, this exceeded all previous auction sales for an alloy Gullwing, the person who bought it knew what they were buying. The previous Gullwing sold at auction weren't matching numbers, didn't have the provenance that this car did. This is essentially like a single owner car, completely matching numbers, a one of one spec to get all Corvette on us. But like they knew what they were getting. This is 100% original car. And although it's in rough condition, it was in probably the least rough condition, at least by the photos, as some of the other cars.
I do have to be honest. A lot of these cars look like they just went through a Gran Turismo lobby on lap one and just like smash. Like, and it's brutal. They're like somebody balled them up like a paper and threw them in the trash. But there are some gems.
There's the Iso Grifo Spider prototype, which sold for $1.8 million. And again, this one doesn't look all that bad. It's not rusty. It just looks like it has a lot of dust on it. Now, this was a record for the particular car, but there really aren't any other comps available as well. So the last semi-comparable car sold in 2018, which is a completely different market from today. So this really made its own market. Now, the odd one was a 62 356B 1600 twin grille roadster, which sold for $1.1 million. That makes no sense.
Why?
That makes no sense.
Is it just a normal, like, normal?
I don't know. It's not a Carrera GT. It's not a four cam car. Like, it's not a speedster. You can buy all those for half of that, less than half. So, not a Carrera GT, but
it's got two grills, Doug.
That one didn't make any sense to me. So, as with any auction, I think you have the outliers on both sides, but then you also have to step back, look at the numbers and go, okay, if this car sold really low, what do the people there with skin in the game, what do they know that we don't? You always have to think about that, and you can't take a data point on its own. There's some crazy results. There's certainly some auction fever here, but I think there's some rationality as well. There's a whole lot of junk that sold for $2,000 to $6,000 nobody really talked about.
Are you maybe talking about what is essentially a tote or a bucket of Mercedes-Benz dash clocks for $1,500? I tried to count how many were in here to see if there was more Porsche engines or dash clocks in this bin. I didn't get it. It's impossible to know.
But, Well, I mean, heck, that's almost, you could buy a complete Porsche 911S for that, but you know, it was completely destroyed. Now, on a separate note, on the heels of this, we transition a little bit, and on P-Car Market, a lesser known online auction place, there's the Burnt Collection now, which is, I think, maybe trying to capitalize on the momentum of this Rust Collection, and I don't know which is worse, Rust or Fire, but there's four classic air-cooled 911s that are being sold on P-Car Market. They were involved in a barn fire, not a barn find, and they are really stinking bad. There is not much left other than the metal, which is kind of different than the Rust Collection. All the metal's gone, and there's some, you know, engines and everything else remaining, but
there is nothing left on these.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how to roast this collection because I feel like it's already been fully roasted. But anyway, the owner obviously experienced a loss. Their barn burned down, and you know, hopefully they got proper insurance payout on the whole deal. But there's some really cheap, I don't even know if you can call them cars anymore. There's just...
There's four of them that I'm kind of flicking through right now. I don't think any of them are usable in any capacity. One of them's got a headlight that was melted so much, it looks like it's crying. It's so depressing. I'm sure somebody can pull something out of these.
The 964 would be a good candidate for an RWB conversion because it's already been ruined, so you can't ruin it anymore.
100%. And somebody's going to clear coat over the burn and then tack the fenders on, and it's going to be like some edgy YouTube thing. But
in theory, though, the engines are probably generally fine in terms of the blocks and the internals and stuff like that. Obviously, everything else is melted, but I think you could make something out of that. But I think they'll go significantly cheaper than what the Rust Collection sold for because there's not the lore surrounding this online auction.
The current bid at the moment for that 964, by the way, is $10,000, and that is kind of depressing.
More than I would pay.
Yeah.
I paid $10,000 for my rust-free, running, complete 911 SC. Granted, that was, you know, 10 years ago, but still. It was a running and complete car, not rusty and not burnt to the ground.
Alrighty. Up now for Shrewd Negotiator this week. All right, I got to be honest. I think the shrewd negotiation here is really us trying to convince you that this belongs in this segment. But
it's
we love it.
It's just fun and entertaining.
So good.
It's just good.
So this comes to us from Down East Maine Traffic and Road Conditions group on Facebook,
which I love. That's my home. That's my home. Shout out to the fellow Mainers here.
So a pine cone here looks to have purchased a 2023 Rolls Royce. Taken out by a pothole.
Couldn't have been anyone actually in Maine. They're probably from Massachusetts.
Yeah. Just drove up for a vacation. I would have hoped, and so the posting says, I would have hoped that if I paid over $600K for a car, it would have some alien technology that would know it was about to drive into the Grand Canyon. So what we're seeing is a Rolls Royce with its tire entirely popped after hitting a pothole.
There are a lot of potholes in Maine. Boom. In fact, the old joke is that you know you're from Maine because you like driving in the winter better because the snow fills the potholes.
If but, only this person knew.
There's also not very many fancy cars up there because of the general road conditions. So when somebody brings a Rolls Royce up there, it's a big deal. But we appreciate the caption and the humor there from that poster. This episode is brought to you by Sheffield All Sport Watches. The Sheffield brand was recently revived by Jay Turkbus, an owner of an original Sheffield All Sport diver he received from his parents in 1970 when he was just 11, beginning his love of watches. As an adult, Jay used his extensive expertise in product development and marketing to revive the brand that started it all. He set out to develop watches with a high level of quality and specification at a value price. His first effort, and a successful one in July of 2023, was the debut of the Sheffield All Sport Diver 1. It had the kind of build and movement that much more expensive watches use, and his debut price of $108 was equivalent to the $13 his parents paid back in 1970. Since that debut, Sheffield has expanded to a wider range of automatics and chronos, many designed around vintage Sheffield dials of the 60s. The Sheffield well of clever and unique design remains his inspiration, as well as maintaining the goal of high quality, very affordable range of automatic and quartz watches. Sheffield watches, value on merit, not just price. I love mine. Get yours at SheffieldWatches.com and mention that you heard about them on Switchcast. People, I don't know who those people are, but people say that supercars are completely unusable, right? Temperamental, unreliable, expensive to fix. They are all of those things. However, when I shipped my Lamborghini Diablo out to California to have a major service done, including a full gearbox rebuild with new clutch and flywheel, I decided I was going to road trip it home.
Well, I love this. Using a vehicle as a vehicle, I'm all about it. Let's go.
I like driving across country, you know. So it was a little bit of an undertaking, but I thought, like, how bad can this be, right? I just spent a fortune having this car serviced. It's going to make it across the country. There's a saying, though, my friend Chuck Loper once told me about his Maserati 3500 GT. And I'm sure it wasn't his saying, but he said that Italian cars are never fixed. They're just sorted, right? They're sorted, which means like they're fixed for now until they're not again, which could be any time in the future, 5 minutes or 5 years. So I had that in mind as I'm flying to California to drive this car across country.
I got to be honest, the couple of times that I have taken a Porsche to Amelia Island or to the Audrey and Concours, I should no longer be nervous about such things because Porsches are like Toyotas compared to Lamborghinis, I feel.
Yes, but like, you also live with anxiety, so you're
it's going to explode.
You're thinking about the acronyms every time you're driving the car. IMS, AOS, RMS, they're all going to fail.
The IMS is going to end up in my lap.
Yes, well, Lamborghinis don't have acronyms. They just...
They're just sorted.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Right. Anyway, so I shipped it out to Fast Cars out in Redondo Beach, California. And this past week, I flew out there with my friend Ed Bullion after the car being there for 6 months being serviced and said, all right, I'm going to road trip this thing from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean. We're going to do this.
Did you feel some need to try to make up for lost time? Because you essentially sent it out as the snow was ending and you brought it back as the snow was going to be coming back.
Yes, I wanted to drive it at least once before the winter happened.
And that once had to count.
So the first day we made it to Flagstaff, Arizona. Getting out of LA was, as usual, a nightmare. We left at about, I think, 2 p.m. So we beat rush hour, but there is no non-rush hour in LA. It is just until you're 200 miles away from LA, the traffic does not die down. It's absolutely insane. Pretty immediately we had some check engine lights. We had some burning smells. We had some, you know, noises and things like that. And Ed said, well, do you want to turn around and abandon this? I said, heck no, we're going until it breaks. So the first day was a little bit, on edge, and, we finally got out of California and we were coming into Flagstaff, and I've driven through Arizona a number of times. And of course it's always like, out in the desert, it can be 80 degrees during the day and it can snow at night. And I did not anticipate that, but we're getting close. And it started raining. And I checked the temperature, and it was like 40 degrees.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, we're still going uphill, and it's getting later at night. Like, this could...
And you're on summer tire, like performance tires, right?
Yes.
So yeah, they're about to be hockey pucks here.
Snow tires yeah. for the Diablo. So I was just a wee bit nervous. Plus, we had the check engine light, not just a solid check engine light. It was flashing, which is, you know, obviously more bad than solid check engine lights. So we roll into an O'Reilly Auto Parts at 10 p.m. in Flagstaff, Arizona. They are beside themselves because an orange Lamborghini pulled up. So I needed a, you know, just a Bluetooth scanner to tell me that more things that I didn't know, right? That's, yes, you have a check engine light, and it told me a bunch of codes, and I was like, okay, well, I have a check engine light. didn't really All give right. me any real information. But we made it to the hotel. Everything was fine. The car was running fine. So it's like, all right, there's no obvious misfires or anything wrong with it. It's going down the road, so we'll keep going. It hailed and thunderstormed that night. Thankfully, we were parked under the awning. And day two was like a relief. If day one was anxiety, day two was like freedom, right? So we're crossing eastern Arizona, all of New Mexico, Texas, and into Oklahoma. Check engine light is still on. Now, we had 91 octane out there, so we tried some octane booster, and that kept the check engine light off for about 2 minutes. But we could fly out there. There's no traffic, no cars, no cops. It was straight. The only issue was crosswinds. There was a heck of a crosswind. So the I always want to call them dust bunnies. The tumbleweeds were flying across the interstate. We're trying to avoid them in the Lambo, like accelerate speed, like trying to predict when they're going to come across. And we missed about 100 of them, but I still hit like 6 or 7. So we had all these scuffs up the front of the front trunk. That was kind of like a settle into the car and be like, okay, well, the check engine lights and the smells and the noises mean nothing because it's still running. And that's all that matters. So we made it to Oklahoma City. We get in there, get out of the car. We're like, oh, man, this hotel is great. They've got a campfire going for us. Well, it wasn't a campfire. The block across from the hotel was closed off by the cops and the fire department because of wildfires.
Oh.
Right. So they were doing controlled burns to try to stop the wildfires because of these high winds that we had just driven through. Thankfully, we escaped that as well. That didn't affect us and you know, didn't turn into a big deal at all. So that was kind of a non-issue. So we got on the road again the next day and made it to Alpharetta, Georgia, which is where Ed Bullion lives. And that day we had to drive through Arkansas, which if any of you watch Arkansas State Police chases and pits and all that stuff on YouTube, they have earned a reputation as being one of the craziest friggin' states ever. Like, you don't run from the cops in Arkansas. You just don't. They'll pit you in like 2 miles. Let me tell you what, they were earning their reputation. We saw more state police in Arkansas than we had seen combined since California. Wow. Also, Arkansas is now my least favorite state to drive in because the left lane hogs are just like, and it was mostly semi-trucks. Like, the left lane road trains were insane.
Was it like drag races at least, or?
No, it was just out? Like, they're just there, just like 10 deep, 2 lanes wide. Just, it was terrible. Mississippi was a little bit better, but not in terms of the state police. I think we saw more state police in Mississippi than we did in Arkansas. So, yeah. But all that said, we made it in 2.5 days from Redondo Beach, California to Alpharetta, Georgia. Made it to Ed's house, took kind of a day off. I put the pumpkin livery on the front of the orange Lamborghini, right? Nice. The jack-o'-lantern thing. And the irony is, right, so Ed has an orange Lamborghini Diablo SV. We're going to put them both out front of his house for trick-or-treating. Well, we didn't have any breakdowns on this whole trip, but Ed's Diablo SUV broke trying to get it out of the driveway.
Seriously?
Yes. What happened? The rear parking brake had like exploded, and it was like the pieces were in the axle, and it was locking it up, so you couldn't rotate the car. Like, you couldn't even push it. It was completely stuck in place. Right.
He just got that back from getting like a whole whack load of work done.
Obviously
not on the parking
brake,
but
my point remains that cars are never done.
Sorted.
They're sorted. Speaking of sorted, we had DC Motorworks do like a mid-trip check over to see if everything was okay, and that helped, and the check engine light went off for like 200 miles because there was a vacuum leak that they found. Came back on again, is still on now, so which means I can't get the car emissions tested, which is nice. Important because my plates are 10 months expired. Yes, we drove across country on expired plates.
That's bold.
Just one of those things, like, it just didn't care. So anyway, the last day we made it to the Hilton Head Island Concours, which was a fantastic show. And then my friend John flew down and we drove it home from the Hilton Head Concours to Ohio. So the total trip stats were 3,500 miles, 15 states, 13 gas stops, a whopping 15 miles to the gallon.
You know, I think that's about what I expected. You can't hope for anything more than that.
It was a lot more than I expected. We were getting crazy gas mileage, and I'm like, something has to be wrong. So Ed looked up the EPA rated mileage for this gas guzzling 6-liter V12 from 2 decades ago. And it was 11 city and 17 highway.
17?
Dude, that's like as good as a Lexus GX460.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's unbelievable.
I'm honestly surprised you only had 13 gas stops.
47 stickers on the rear wing. Ed loves stickers, and he decided to make the rear wing his art project. So at every gas stop, truck stop, whatever, he would buy stickers that were, you know, had to do with where we were, and created his canvas on the rear wing. So it was
he really
quite
went to
a
town.
Thing. Yes. Zero tickets. Zero quarts of oil lost.
Ooh.
Zero unscheduled stops. Zero calls to AAA. And honestly, it was quite an adventure. We learned that hotel room keys make fantastic interior shims to fix squeaks. Yeah. But I think the biggest thing that I learned, right? So shipping the car out to California was that there's a number of reasons I did it. We don't need to go into all of them, but I wanted it to go to a shop that I trusted. That was the biggest thing. We've talked about scams like CPR Classics, where people ship their cars there for service, and like they have to go rescue their cars before the feds impound them, right? I didn't want that. There are better and worse options. Maybe I could have saved a little money here or there. Maybe another shop would have gotten something else better or worse than this particular shop. But I knew that they would do the work and do it right and stand behind it. But what did I learn about servicing a supercar and using a supercar, right? I think one is that the better plan is not to fly out and just like hoon it across country, right? It doesn't matter how good of a contractor you hire to build your house, you still need to supervise them. It doesn't matter how good of a service shop you have and how detailed your list is, you still need to personally check it. So I think the better plan would have been to fly out, do a 1,000-mile coastal California tour, and then take it back and say, here's my updated list. You got it sorted. Now do the second round of sorting, right? Cars always need that finishing, even brand new cars. That's why they test them after they build them, right? A fresh car doesn't mean it's finished or good or ready. It just means it's like assembled.
Well, there's also an aspect to, you know, your car, and you know, I believe that, you know, shops can be incredible. I have had some awesome mechanics work on my cars, but you still get so finely tuned with your own vehicle. You will notice if things are maybe slightly off that are not going to be noticed by someone, no matter how much they know and no matter how skilled they are.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. And then the other thing is, right, so like I gave them a list of what's wrong and they found some more things.
As they always do.
I wasn't paying them to fix everything that could be wrong in the future. That bill would be like 5x. If I said, do a mechanical restoration, fix anything that could ever potentially be a problem versus find what is a problem now and fix that, right? So in 3,500 miles, I mean, that's more than most people drive their Lamborghinis in 3 years. Like, you're just going to uncover things. And some of the noises that came up and some of the things that happened were not a problem when I left the shop, but 2,000 miles later, they were. So that's just, that's part of living with a supercar. But I loved, and it solidified in my mind that a Diablo, specifically a 6 liter, is a great car to own and live with. Now, in my mind, that should make it worth more money, because I've looked at other supercars like a Jaguar XJ220, Bugatti EB110, and they're all worth far more than Diablo. And I'm going, why? Because the parts costs are insane. The parts availability is insane. It's so hard to live with and work on. The Diablo is one of the most usable supercars on the planet. They should be worth way more than these other crazy temperamental cars that, you know, you may not even be able to get parts for. But then I realized the people who are driving the value, that are seeing these cars as investments, don't care about driving them, because driving them decreases the value anyway. So they don't care if they're good to drive across the country or reliable or you can get parts, because they're an art piece. They're an investment. So,
which is just so, we've talked about it a lot, and it's so depressing because we like to drive our stuff, and we know a lot of you guys like to drive your stuff, and it would be awesome if a lot of some things were a little cheaper and not driven by people who just like to have a car sit. But this is the world we live in, and I just love that you have gone out and proven that you can use these cars.
Yeah, it was great. Drove it across country, drove it everywhere. It was fantastic.
So you're going to get it sorted? You're going to sort it again?
Sort it again. Hopefully get it through e-check, get my plates legal.
Are we taking it to Amelia in March?
I might not go to Amelia.
Really?
Anyway, that brings us to the props and flops brought to you by Switch Cars.
And Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, and consign only cars that we like ourselves. Check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention Switchcast for special pricing. Find more information at switchcars.com or come visit our showroom in beautiful Twinsburg, Ohio. Doug, what is our pick of the week from Switch Cars Inventory?
Our pick of the week is a 2024 Corvette Z06. It is definitely a one-of-one specification. It is greenish gray over grayish green. There's a technical term for both of those colors. If it was a Porsche, it would be granite green, but it's not a Porsche. It has ceramic brakes. I literally put in my show notes PCCBs. That would be Porsche yes. Carbon ceramic brakes. This is where my mind is. And guess what? It is 20 grand off MSRP. That's right. MSRP on this car is 140 grand, and we will sell it for 120. So we talked about the Z06 market a couple weeks ago, proof that our theoretical discussion about the market aligns with and is rooted in reality. Our flop of the week comes from Hilton Head Island Concours, not the Concours itself. The Concours was fantastic. It's the first time I've ever been to that show. They did a great job for a smaller event. I like to say it's small in size, but not in stature. And there was a McLaren F1 there, chassis number 73, finished in a one-off orange custom metallic color,
but not the amazing, like papaya orange that a lot of people think of.
Not the papaya orange that is the McLaren F1 LM is finished in, which is important. We'll get to that shortly. It does have an LM spec motor, and it does have the high downforce kit, so the front splitter and different bumper and the rear wing. But it is described as an F1 LM. It has the front and rear license plate F1 LM. But there's 6 F1 LMs, including the experimental one that McLaren owns, and 4 of them are finished in the traditional papaya orange, other than 2 that the Sultan of Brunei owns. We're getting real nerdy here.
Well, he owns 3, technically. One of them is still orange. 2 of them are painted like race cars.
Sorry, the 2 that are not orange that he owns. And, But this is not one of them. This is a regular F1 with an LM spec motor with a rear wing and front splitter.
But also, because I think I have seen this car before. I think it was at Amelia.
It was.
The high downforce kit is not an LM kit. It looks slightly different.
Correct. And it does not have the side skirts either.
Yeah.
Or the interior or the, you know, the commemorative badging or just, it's just not one of the six, period. Yeah. Right? It's five numbered ones, right? Because you have the XP1 yes. and then you have 01, 02, 03, 04, 05 of 05. This one isn't one of those five, but you know, apparently the owner's convinced or dead set on it being represented as an LM, and it's not. Like, it's the worst, most expensive case of up badging ever in history. Yeah. So our prop of the week, though, yes. is that same McLaren F1.
Okay.
Right. So despite the up badging, I had an incredible like childhood moment where the owner or curator, whoever was in charge of this car at the Concours, had all the like the kid judges around. You know, they send them around with notepads and stuff. And he was explaining in detail what made the McLaren F1 special.
Heck yeah.
And he was opening every door and luggage compartment, and he's asking them questions and getting them excited about the car. And it was awesome because it's like, I know that car inside and out in terms of the statistics and what makes it cool. And so I knew everything that he was telling these kids because I learned it when I was a kid. And that's what made me love the F1. And he is instilling in them the same excitement and passion for the car that I had for all of the right reasons, right? It's the fastest car in the world, 242 miles an hour. It's the, you know, it was the fastest car in the world for 12 years until the Bugatti Veyron beat it. It has gold foil insulation in the engine bay to protect the body panels from the heat. It has luggage compartments on the side and custom made luggage to fit in those compartments. And the driver sits in the middle and, you know, still the fastest naturally aspirated car ever made. And he's going through all these different things with the kids. And not once did he talk about how it's worth $20 million or how it's one of 64 or rare or has only three owners or anything like that that kids don't care about. It was just pure, unadulterated automotive passion. And I loved it and I appreciated it. And it was a great, great moment. Thank you for joining us for Switchcast with Doug Tabbitt and Tyler Sanders, produced by Ethan Huffnagel. Switchcast is an automotive entertainment and opinion show, and nothing we say should be taken very seriously. We do not give tax, investment, legal, emotional, or professional advice, and the only licenses we hold are driver's licenses. The opinions expressed on this show are exclusively held by the people pontificating at that moment and do not reflect the values of our producers or sponsors. Our theme music is provided by Emily and Ivory. You can stream their full album on Spotify or SoundCloud. If you like this show, you can stream it in its entirety on your favorite audio podcast platform. Check out switchcast.live for more info.